I'm Bob Stevens. This is my wife, Doris. This is going to be a teen-taught workshop. Actually, as I told her on the way in this morning, that I was going to tell you that the only reason I got involved in this workshop at all is, I guess a couple years ago we put this together, mainly because our kids are about grown now and Doris needs a new ministry, and so I wanted to get her involved in it. Give her a platform from which to use her gifts. And as you'll find out, she has a gift of teaching. We'd like to get acquainted with you and get a little picture of your family. So, Gordon, why don't we start with you, and we'll just go right down the row here and tell us what your family size and age is.
We have three children. We have a girl who's 10, be 11 very soon. Boy just turned 9.
Uh-huh. We have a more or less in bedroom, but we have two little girls. Jody, the oldest, we have four, and then it's Jessica, because they're
good.
I'm sure more, so we have a almost 2-year-old and one on the way, and my sister works in music, that's part time. She's 16.
Mm-hmm. I'm Mark Johnson. We have three kids, girl 15, boy 10, and girl 8.
My name is Maria Ty. We have two boys. Jonathan is 14 months, and Nathan is 2 years, 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
My boss, Schneider, is my wife, Helen. We have boy 13 and girl 9. We have two girls and two kids. Helen, milking. Makes forward, cheap.
Grandparents, we have a boy 13, girl 9.
Good. 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 We've got quite a range from minus through several months to 15, did you say? See, you had 15. No, hers is 13. Well, she has a sister, 16. We have three children. I have a boy, Mark, 21, and a girl who's 19, and a boy, Robbie, who's 15. And both of our older ones are, in fact, they're all living at home still. Both of the older ones are going to college here in Colorado Springs at University of Colorado, studying engineering. And some of you may have prayed for our oldest son, who was in an accident about 18 months ago up at Eagle Lake and crushed his heel and broke his leg and had a lot of complications. Finally got them all back together. And last week he broke the same leg again skiing at Vail. And so we almost canceled the workshop because we were so swamped with not only getting ready for the conference, but then he was in the hospital for 4 days last week and all involved there, and he's now home, has to be helped in and out of bed and everything, but his sister's there taking care of him.
Same
leg in exactly the same spot, which causes some complications. It heals more slowly the second time you break a bone in the same spot. We always, I think, are nervous or hesitant about teaching a workshop on how to raise kids because the results of your ministry may become evident or are on public display, and you're never done with that job, really, as you know. We are very encouraged with the way the Lord has worked in our family so far. We'd like some of them to be more committed to the Lord, but we haven't had any that went off in rebellion yet. And we feel like we have a happy family situation. We really enjoy them, and it's a real privilege to have them all home this far along in their college careers. This is the last year that we'll have all three at home. The two oldest ones have to leave to continue their education after one more year. The way we got started in this particular subject is by doing an exhaustive Bible study on the subject of raising kids. I went through the concordance, complete concordance, and located every verse I could find in the Bible that had anything at all to say about raising kids. Did this several years ago, and then categorized those verses. And I was surprised to find that they fell into four principles, that all the verses that I could find in the Scripture produced four principles for raising kids. And so since this is a workshop, we'd like you to do a little work, and we're going to start off with a Bible study. I'm going to give you a few verses on each one of these four principles, and then give you some time to look them up and see if you can determine what the principle is from these verses. So here are the verses that I've selected for each one of the four principles, and I'll leave those up there for 15 minutes or so. If you could just look them up, and then write down what you think each one of those four principles is from those four verses. Any questions on that?
First Timothy 3:4-12.
How many of you are done? Okay, that's most of you. Well, what did you get for principle number one? Okay, your own personal life, your own personal walk with God, or pace setting, the effect of your life on the life of your kids. And the reason I listed that one number one, in fact, these are in order of the number of verses there are in the Bible on each one of those topics that I found. And this first one was by far the most mentioned. There was probably as many verses on this one as all the others put together. The importance of the example of our life in training our kids. Okay, how about the second one? Discipline, right. Discipline and correction. The importance of discipline. And the third one? Teaching and training, right. There's a little overlap between discipline and teaching and training, which we'll talk about when we get into it. And the last one? Prayer, right. Well, those were the four, in other words, all the verses fell into those four main categories. And so we'll take the first two today and the second two tomorrow. Most of the material we have is on the subject of training. So that's why we'll cover that, primarily that topic tomorrow. But to start off with, the importance of setting the example or godly living. We probably don't really need to say a whole lot about that to navigators because we recognize the validity of that principle in our own ministry with students or military or community, that our own life is the most important aspect in the fruit we're going to bear in our ministry. And of course, that doesn't change in our home. In fact, it's probably even emphasized more strongly in ministering to our kids because they are with us totally and observe our lives in every situation and in every condition. And so it's the most important factor in the training of our kids. Joe Aldridge, who was our pastor in California for a couple of years and who's now the president of Multnomah Bible College and has written several books, tells about his earliest recollections of his father are seeing his father out milking the cow early in the morning with a Bible propped up on a stool so that he can read the Bible while he's milking the cow. And that's the That's the way he first remembered his dad, was the example of his dad reading the Bible early in the morning while he was working. They say that the number one problem in the Christian home, in fact, Chuck Swindoll, in his book, You and Your Child, which is an excellent book, by the way, says that the number one problem in the Christian home in America is the passive husband and father. The father who is not assuming his responsibilities as the leader spiritually of the home. For several years, two or three years, I was involved in finance calling with the Navigators back in the late 50s and early 60s, working for Rod Sargent, along with Ron Ortley and Jim White and several others of that vintage. And we had a little machine, and we would go into a home, we'd make an appointment, go into a home, we'd show our little film strip about the Navigators, and then we had a little financial pitch that we took them through, and then we came to the place where it was their opportunity to respond, whether they wanted to help the Navigators financially or not. And Rod had trained us to make our presentation to the husband, because he's the head of the home and the one who should make decisions of this type. So we would always try and we'd look at the husband when we were making our presentation, and then when we came to the place where we paused to wait for their response, it almost became humorous. It happened so often. We would have made the presentation, pause, and the wife would speak up. And she'd say, "Well, I don't think," or, "Yes, I think we ought to do something here. Don't you, honey?" And it was very obvious. And we would try and we'd respond back to the husband, and the wife would answer again, and we'd respond back to the husband. And it was very obvious to me as a young Christian in those days that the men were not assuming their responsibility as the head of the home. So we as husbands need to set the example by taking the leadership in the matter of not only training the children, but every aspect of having a Christian home. In Psalm 127:1, let's see, somebody has my Bible. Are you done with my... Thank you. If you'll turn to Psalm 127, there's several verses here that are appropriate. Most of you are probably familiar with Psalm 127:1, which says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." I'd like to point out that unless we make Christ the foundation of our family, then all the other things that we do are in vain. And of course, unless we make Christ the foundation of our life, everything else is in vain. And in verse 2, it says, "It's in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil." If you have not made Christ the foundation of your family, and if you're not living for Him, then all the anxious toil and effort that you put into raising the children is not going to be very effective. And of course, we have in our society an epidemic of people who are trying by anxious toil to compensate for a lack of love and attention and care to their kids. In other words, you cannot, by providing material things to your family, make up for a lack of spiritual foundations. And then in verse 3 it says, "Lo, sons are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward." And we have to realize that our children are a gift from God. They're not interruptions in our ministry. They're not burdens. They're not financial problems. They're gifts from God that have been entrusted to us, and they belong to Him. He's loaned them to us, and they're our responsibility to raise. Well, just some of the areas. Doris, would you like to pass out these handouts for them, help them take notes on? Just some of the areas. I didn't want to pass them out until after we'd identified the 4 points. Some of the areas that are really important in our life, I think, are our own personal quiet time. And if you were not a Navigator staff group, I would go into an exhortation on the quiet time, but I don't think any of us need that. I think we are all aware of the importance of that in our own life. We probably all need to do a better job of being faithful at it, but we know we need to do it. And, of course, our children imitate us. As Joe Aldridge saw his dad reading the Bible while he was milking the cow, I can remember my children coming in, and as I was having my quiet time, coming in and sitting beside me on the sofa with their little picture book or something and having their quiet time. And they do copy us. Sunday school and church attendance. Very obvious that we need to set the example and not send the kids, but go with them, not only to church, but to Sunday school as well. We feel this is very important. Chuck Swindoll points out that church and school cannot replace the family in providing training for the children. The church and the school can supplement the family, but if there's a defective training in the family or a defective situation in the family, the school and the church cannot be expected to overcome that. Bible study. We have tried to make Bible study a normal activity in our household so that the kids have grown up just assuming that everybody is supposed to be involved in Bible study. And of course, around the NAV ministry, that's not too difficult. Most of you have Bible studies in your home and are involved in Bible studies. We've had Bible study with our kids also. In fact, as a result of this accident of our son, we've agreed to start another Bible study this winter with the kids. So Bible study should be a normal activity of a Christian by their observing how you live your life. The same with witnessing. Witnessing should be a normal activity in our lives, and our kids should see us witnessing in just the normal course of life. And we've had some very interesting times by having non-Christians in our homes or going to non-Christian relatives and having opportunity to share with them about Christ. We had a real interesting time one time out in Oregon with Doris's family. She has several non-Christian brothers. And we were having quite a spirited discussion with one of them. And I suppose it went on for an hour or so. And we have learned over the years that after a certain point, those discussions reached their limit of profitability with some people like that. And so we felt that we had done all we could do in that conversation. And we kind of backed out. And the kids were sitting watching. And this was 3 or 4 years ago, so they were teenagers. And as soon as we quit, our kids just jumped right in and took up the battle and had a great time for another hour or two. And this particular brother who's kind of philosophically oriented, really enjoyed talking with our kids and told us later, you know, your kids, they've got better points than you do. Because our kids were a little more current on some of the philosophy and that type of thing than we are. So we were encouraged, and that ought to be a normal part of our life, and that we ought to involve our kids with it. We've tried to involve our kids as much as possible in our total life, as you'll see as we go on with the seminar. And then the area of giving is a key area in the Christian life, and one of the things that we have done is involved our children in the discussion of our giving, Christian giving. Who are we going to give to? How much are we going to give? And let them know that this is a part of life. About 2.5 years ago now, I had gone to California to run a company that had been given to the Navigators. And after I got out there, the Navigators found out that it was not wise legally to have a staff member running a secular company because of liability. Potential liability suits and this type of thing. So I left the staff and was working strictly with this company. And after a year or so, I decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life doing that and asked if I could get back into a more normal assignment. And so they worked something out. I was worked out this job that I have now. And then we hired a man who was going to take over the company. And the company could not support both he and I. And my daughter had about 8 months before she graduated from high school. And we had moved her in the middle of her high school career, and we didn't want to move her again in the middle of her senior year. So I quit my job with the company, but was not starting my navigator job for about 8 or 9 months. And so we had no income, no prospects of income for that time, because we had given up all our support when we went out to work for this secular company. And so we were discussing this in the family, and our daughter Amy said, well, one thing for sure, we don't want to stop our giving. And so we were very encouraged to see how giving had been built in by letting them be a part of our discussions and knowing what we were doing in that area of our life. Okay, Doris, do you want to come up and take over from here? We'll be switching back and forth here all day.
I don't know where you're going to. Can it fit in my name tag?
We'll see. Okay.
I don't think that's going to work.
How's that? Can you hear? Well, just before I go on into love, I would like to say that things we're sharing are things that we feel that God has taught us over the years. It's not, you know, we haven't arrived at this. And as you'll see, as we go over these things, a lot of our things are negative examples. We did the wrong things. But many of the things, yes. But many of the things, I just feel that God led us to do, and He led us to do the right thing at the right time. And when we were married and had our family, when the kids were real young, there weren't a lot of books on family and what to do. And I just feel that God really led us in that. And I think also being under the ministry of Joe Aldrich was a real factor in our family, because he had so much that he told about from having been raised in a Christian home. And neither of us were from a Christian home. And just to hear it from a child who grew up in a Christian home, the things that were important to him and that meant something to him, that was helpful, I think, to us. Well, in the area of love, first of all, love your spouse. And Lauren Sanney has said, the greatest thing you can do for your children is to love your wife. And I'm sure he meant for us wives to love our husbands. And I don't know about you, but if you've observed your children, you realize that they do get a great sense of security out of knowing that you really love each other. And I think especially in our world where so many marriages are ending in divorce, it's even more important than ever before that they see the love that we have for one another. And then to love your child. And Howie Hendricks says in his book, Say It With Love, the one thing I ask God for concerning my children is that they know I love them. And you know, when you hold that little baby in your arms, it's not too hard to love them. I mean, they need you, they're helpless, and, you know, that emotion is there. But as they get a little older, and they begin to do things that are contrary to what you think, it's not always easy to love them then, is it? Well, that's where I think asking God to give us that love comes in. And only as we walk with God every day, are we going to have the love that we need and, you know, the ability to be the right kind of a person for them. And with babies, we hold and rock them. And then as they get older, when they get even to be teenagers, I kind of wish now I hadn't drawn back. As my boys got into their teens, I thought, well, they probably don't want their mother coming in to kiss them goodnight. And, you know, they'll be embarrassed if I touch them. And yet, my 15-year-old, loves to have me kiss him when he walks out the door on the way to school. You know, I think it surprises me, but they have a need for love. Or I'll walk in and sit down, and he'll lay down across my lap and have me scratch his back. You know, they need our touch, our kisses and affection. And as you know, as they get older, I think we'll have to know the Lord will have to lead us in the right amount. But they still need it, even when they're. When I put my 21-year-old in bed, I touched him on the head. We had a little talk, you know, but they just need it, don't they? And then something we've done a lot of in our family is trying to have fun together, and there are just lots of things you can do. Probably one of the highlights has been having a little travel trailer, and we've camped a lot up at Eagle Lake, and we've taken our trailer coast to coast at different times with the kids, and it's just been a real highlight. As the older two look back, they look back on those times that we were camping as a family as a real highlight. Last May, our oldest son said to us, are we going to go camping on Memorial Day? Because that was always our first, you know, camping trip of the summer, and he was all ready to do that again, even though he was 21 years old. So they don't get tired of those kinds of things. And I was going to say skiing, but I'm sure that it's been a good experience, and I'm sure Mark is learning a lot through, you know, having a second broken leg. And skiing has been a really good activity for us as a family. We have always made the children pay their share of the expenses, so it hasn't been that great a financial burden on us. But I think it's been, we've had some good times, you know, staying in a ski condominium and just skiing together and being together. And then another thing we've done is we've developed kind of family traditions around birthdays. When it's your birthday, that's kind of a special day. You get to choose your menu, and we, when they were younger, we'd decorate the table and maybe put up a sign, and sometimes they put up signs for us too. Like I had one when I turned 40 that showed me at the peak going downhill. But it's been fun to see how, you know, we just can express ourselves, and that's a special time for them. And I'm sure you can think of lots of things, and they don't have to be expensive things. They can be taking walks, hiking. A lot of times Bob will make a big pot of popcorn in the evening, and we'll just all gather and eat popcorn and talk for a while. And it's just something that we've all enjoyed doing. And then in the matter of humility, being an example, of course we have to admit our wrongs to them. And as a parent, there are many times when we blow it and we have to say, you know, I'm sorry, I was wrong. And I think that really helps them know that we're human and that, you know, we're like they are. We make mistakes too. And then in the matter of honesty, just being, we have to be meticulous in every area because they're watching, you know, from the minute they can read, you'll be driving down the street going 35 miles an hour in a 25-mile zone, and they'll say, hey, Mom, how come you're going 10 miles over the speed limit? And they're just very quick to catch those things. And just, you know, by the way we obey the law, they will obey the law. And then the matter of restaurant bills. You know, if the restaurant makes a mistake in adding up our bill, and we've had several times where we've went back and say, well, look, we really owe you more money than you've charged us. And that just helps them to do that sort of thing, makes it easier for them. And then another area that we've, different people will have different ideas on this, but we have never emphasized Santa Claus in our family. Just because we wanted Jesus to be the center of the Christmas season, we have, I mean, they know the story of Santa Claus, but we never told them that Santa Claus was going to bring them any presents or, you know, and we kind of opened our gifts on Christmas Eve purposely to squelch the idea that there was a Santa Claus. We were concerned that if we told them that Santa Claus did all these things, and then we told them about Jesus, and then later we tell them that there is no Santa Claus, in their minds they might not get that clear. And so we've kind of just avoided that. And I don't really think they've suffered any other than they've probably ruined other children's Christmases by saying there's no Santa Claus. But that's an individual thing. And then one example of really being honest and being a person of your word was when we moved from Colorado Springs before, we received an offer on our house that was $2,000 less than what we were asking. And we made a verbal agreement with the people that we would take that offer. And just about, 2 hours later, another man that had looked at the house called up and wanted to come over. And he said he was going to pay us full price. But we had given our word. We had not signing legal documents or anything, but we'd given our word, and so we stuck to our original agreement, and our children knew this. And this is the type of thing, I think it's good to bring them in on this, so they just get used to living that way. They know this is the way a Christian lives. This is the kind of things we do. And then in the area of attitude, Unfortunately, they pick up our attitudes, don't they? And none of us are perfect. And in our respect for authority, you know, when it gets time to pay the taxes, do we moan and groan about, oh no, you know, I've got to pay these taxes again, or I'm sure the police are just out to get me if I get a traffic ticket, or even, you know, the pastor of the church, we can say things that will influence their minds and make them think negatively, when really we should be building these things up. And then the respect for the property rights of other people. And I think this is something that's really suffering in our culture today. I think of a time when we were living in England, I think the English are a little more conscious about their property being their particular domain. And we were over at an American friend's house, and he and his son were playing ball, and the ball bounced over the fence into the next yard, and they just hopped over the fence to get it. And the man came out and he said, "What are you doing in my garden?" You know, and that's the type of thing that we, you know, when something like that happens, we do. We need to go to the door and ask the people for permission to go into their yard. Or if a little old lady down the street has an apple tree, it isn't all right to just automatically go by and take the apples off. You know, those are the kind of things that we need to work on. And then we have some friends who have a condominium in Breckenridge. Probably many of you stayed up there or been in it. But we know that it's loaned out mainly to Christians. And we have been a little surprised that the care it's gotten. And that's another, you know, thing. As a Christian, we need to be sure that we're as careful with other people's things as we are with our own. And it's not, you know, that's just not a natural thing. I think that's something that the Lord has to help us do. And then we've tried to instill in our kids the value of school. And we've told them that if they're going to put their time in there, they might as well make it count. And it's, you know, a lot of times you can think of school as just another fun activity, just someplace you should go and have lots of fun and be involved in all kinds of activities. But really, it's their foundation for the future, their education. And so they need to really work at it. And we've always had a little phrase, you know, as they go out the door, work hard to help them, you know, apply themselves. And one, an interesting statistic to me is that 4% of the American high school graduates, only 4% have taken calculus. And so we have really worked at encouraging our kids to take challenging courses. It might mean that they'll have to spend more time studying than other kids, and they might not have as much time for activities. But I really, you know, their education is more important than all these extracurricular activities that they sometimes can get involved in. And here again, we have to be very careful in our attitude toward the school and the teachers, that we are very positive. And when our daughter was in junior high, I made a comment about one of the teachers not being a very good motivator. And our daughter has a tendency to tell people things. Well, she went to school and told the teacher that her mother didn't think he was a very good motivator. So I ended up having to, you know, apologize to the teacher, and we became quite good friends after that. But, you know, that's the kind of thing you don't want to do. Don't put the teacher down. And then the respect for the rights of children. And I think it's really easy in a busy lifestyle that most of us have to just, as long as they seem happy, we tend to think, well, they're fine. But we need to really work at listening and drawing them out. I like what Chuck Swindoll says in his book about just listening to your children. He uses the verse in Proverbs 20, verse 5. I think, counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. And just apply that to your children. That we have to work at drawing them out. And I know that our older son, there are many things that I didn't know about him until he was out of high school. And then he would just tell me. He'd say, well, when I was a sophomore, you know, this happened and such and such. And I said, why didn't you tell me? So I was afraid you'd get all upset about it, Mother, or worried about it. And so we really need to work at drawing them out and hearing what they're saying. And as we're often saying around the table, I think that's one of the times that we can listen, you know, ask them about their day. We're enjoying them, and as you hear them express themselves, you can pick up you know, how things are really going with them. They need to have their own room, their own space, their own possessions. Now, maybe it's not possible to have a private room, but they need to have an area that they know is theirs and that you're not going to be going through, and we need to respect their privacy. I think this, you know, comes as they get a little older, not when they're just preschoolers. And I think of the home as a place of refuge where they can be themselves and kind of get replenished for going back out into the battle. And it's a lot different, I know, today than it was when I was growing up. I think kids have it a lot harder, the things that they're facing, the things they're exposed to even at school. We just want to make sure that when they come home, they can, you know, let down and express what they're really feeling and what they're going through. And then in the area of not provoking your children to wrath from Ephesians 6:4, again, I'm taking from Joel Aldrich. He says this is a point of continual pecking or an overemphasis on the negative and how easy this is as a parent to do. You know, we want them to be perfect, and so we just always see the things they're doing wrong. I think especially as mothers. I don't know why this is addressed to fathers in the scripture, because I think mothers are more prone to do this because we see the little details, you know. Pick up your socks, do this, straighten your bed, don't do that, do this. And he says we can discourage them to the place where they just give up all hope of ever pleasing us. And so that's, I think that's really something important to keep in mind, that we don't so emphasize the negatives that they become discouraged and lose all hope of ever pleasing. Okay.
We should have mentioned at the beginning, if you have any questions as we go along, just speak up. So before we go into this next major section, do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make?
Gordon? What age, Doris or Bosu, you joined that, you know, respect those privacy rights, and which obviously not with preschool is not that big a deal. Is there a magic number? I know one day it's not and one day it is.
Mm-hmm.
About what age?
Well, in all these type of things, it varies with the child and his sense of how much privacy he wants and everything, but probably...
I'd say before junior high, I think most children by 8 or so want some feeling. Mm-hmm. Our kids always know. Mm-hmm. And it's like, when they want privacy, they do the right.
Mm-hmm. You say they will let you know?
They
do, right, right. They're all different, aren't they?
Well, I was wondering with the practice 14:26, where it talks about the parents of the Lord, it said the children will have refuge. Is it refuge or refuge from the parents?
I haven't, I'm not current on the verse, Susan. I really can't answer that. Can anybody else comment on that? I think with the little children, the refuge is in their parents, probably. And then as they get older, that gets transferred to God. Okay, well, let's go into the matter of discipline. Discipline is for the purpose of training. The dictionary definition of training has two aspects. The first is taming something that is wild. And the second is developing a taste for the good and nourishing things. And so obviously, the first part, taming something that is wild, has to do with discipline, setting limits and establishing some controls. Discipline has to be tailored to each child because they're each different. And with our children, our daughter was just totally unmoved by spankings. She has a very strong will, and refused to cry or to be affected by the spanking. But we discovered that by withholding her dessert, she would just dissolve into tears. You know, that would be a crushing thing for her. And so you have to learn how to get to each child. You know, what is going to have an effect on them. But mainly with the young ones, we used a wooden spoon. And mainly with young children, you are enforcing rules because they're too young to understand the whys and to be able to think and realize that it's dangerous to run out in the street and it's dangerous to open the medicine cabinet and take pills and this type of thing. So you have to have certain don'ts. But we think a very important point in discipline is that as the children get older, we switch from rules to principles. And we have been very free. In fact, we encourage their asking questions about why do we have this rule? Why should we do this? And we feel that if we can't explain reasonably and adequately why we have a rule, then maybe we should examine why, you know, maybe we shouldn't have the rule. And so we don't consider questioning our rules as disrespect or rebellion, but it's part of the learning process, and that they should be encouraged to ask, what's the reason for this? And because the thing we want to communicate is not a list of rules, but spiritual principles. And if they cannot substantiate and understand the reason for the rules, then as soon as they get out from under our authority, the rules will go out the window very quick. As they get older, you move from inflicting pain with a wooden spoon to withholding privileges, like TV watching, or as they get to be teenagers, the use of the car, and so on. So that the primary means of discipline after the very young age, we have found to be more withholding privileges rather than spankings. Now, the key to taming the wild child, and they're all born with that sin nature, is first of all to seek to bring them to salvation in Christ. That's the most important thing. And the second thing is to use the rod and reproof. From Proverbs 29:15, talks about the rod and reproof will drive foolishness from the child. The rod, of course, is either the spoon or the withholding of privilege. Bruce?
I hope so. If I stop there. At what point are each child going to be different? At what point do you see the change from the wild child to the adult child?
Well, usually the first question is that at what age do you start discipline? And maybe Doris, you'd like to comment on that. John?
Well, in 6 months of child conception, they can understand their name, their identity, and just a lot of psychology that is a more difficult concept than a self-identity than is the concept of obedience or love. So that's
Okay, at what age then, Bruce's question is, do you begin to switch from corporal punishment to more withholding privileges? And of course it varies with child.
Direct disobedience. I don't know how old it is. I don't know if mine's only 13. I don't know if I was 14. Mm-hmm. But if it's direct disobedience, she's still going to stand.
Well, here it probably varies with with the child. The question I have is what hurts the child most? A teenager can take a spanking pretty well. They may put up a show to make you, make you feel like it's really hurting, but it doesn't hurt near as much as not watching the Monday night football game or something like that. And so I think probably when they begin to have things that are really important to them that you can use. Now, we probably discontinued spanking by before they were teenagers, didn't we? We didn't always just sit down and plan this all out and say, okay, now we are going to switch from this to that. But we just learned that some things are more effective than a spanking. You know, no dessert. Even for our daughter, when she was 2 and 3 years old, the spankings were not effective. But withholding food was dessert. Our daughter's now 6'1". We're glad we did withhold a little food. She was a voracious eater. She's not overweight, she's just tall. Okay. The verse Proverbs 29:15 talks about the rod and reproof. The rod is the punishment or the withholding of privilege, and the reproof is explaining why you're doing it. And it's important to have both. If you punish without them understanding really why this is happening, you haven't accomplished anything. So the reproof is the explanation of the why for the punishment. Now, it's very important for mom and dad to be in agreement on what the standards in the house are and what the punishment's going to be. And if you're like us, this is a real difficult thing because we do have different standards. We come from different backgrounds, different families. And by nature, we have different temperaments. And so we really have to work at being together in whether or not if this happens, we really are going to do this. You know, if Robbie doesn't make his bed, are we really going to not let him watch TV that night then? And if he doesn't make his bed a couple days in a row, then what? That we're in agreement, because it's difficult to enforce these things sometimes, and we really have to mean it. And it's important to mean what you say. If we say that we're going to do something and they meet the conditions, then we ought to do that, both from a positive and a negative standpoint. They need to learn that our word, that we mean what we say, and that we don't have to be shouting and yelling and waving our arms to make it true, that if we just say it, it's true. And we really work at this.
Have you ever changed on something? Say something happens and Doris does something about it, and you get home and discuss it and say, oh, no, we're not going to do that. But didn't you change your mind?
We have occasionally. Mm-hmm. And we explain it to the kids, too, that, you know, we've decided that was a little extreme, or that we need to tighten up a bit here. So now we wouldn't go back and change a decision that we'd made to make it more strict. We might make it more lenient, but we wouldn't change the rules in the middle of the game to their detriment. We really try and be consistent, which is the next point. My spiritual father is Leroy Imes, and the very first contact I had after meeting him at church, he invited me over for dinner that week, and as Doris mentioned, neither one of us came from a Christian home. The thing that really impressed me about them was their children and the relationship they had with their children. When 8 o'clock came, Leroy said, well, kids, it's 8 o'clock. And the kids said, okay, Dad. And they went up and went to bed. Well, in my family, boy, nothing like that ever happened. You know, we fought and hid and argued and everything we could to keep from going to bed. That was a big hassle. But all he said was, it's 8 o'clock, and they knew that meant go to bed. And so I learned that children can learn to obey without being shouted at and yelled at. And it's totally up to the parents. And the mothers, of course, have the biggest problem with this because they're with the children more. And they have more opportunities to enforce things. And we really have to work at not saying it the second time and the third time louder and louder so that they learn that when you reach a certain decibel level, that is when you start obeying. But when you say it the first time, normal tone, they will learn to listen. It's kind of like announcements at conferences. You know, if we give verbal announcements, then that's what people are going to listen to. But if we put it in a printed form and we don't say any more, it doesn't take long to learn, hey, those are the announcements, and we better read them because they're not going to say them. You know, that's the only word we're going to get. And it doesn't take kids long to learn that. And it makes for a happier situation all around if we can not get into the shouting and yelling act with our kids. Uniform standards for all the children. Jacob and Esau were children of Isaac and Rebekah. Isaac liked Esau because he was like him, and Rebekah liked Jacob because he was like her. He was a sensitive type child, and Isaac, Esau was a hunter and a more of a man's man. And so the parents each had their favorite, and it didn't take the kids long to figure that out, and it caused a lot of problems in the family. And we can do that unconsciously. We can have favorites. We can have different standards for different children. And we realized when Doris had a interview with one of our teachers when our kids were in grade school, and the teacher said that our son told us that he wasn't as smart as his sister. And she said, are you doing anything to communicate this impression to him? And we realized that our daughter, who is very aggressive and more outgoing, was getting more attention and more praise, and she did more things than he. And so he picked up that he wasn't as smart as his sister because of the way we responded to them. So we really have to be careful about this, that we treat each one alike and we have uniform standards. It really becomes difficult when you have 20-year-olds and young teenagers living in the same home because they have different privileges. You know, there's no way that we would expect our 20-year-old to abide by the same rules or restrictions that our younger teenager, and so we have a little difficulty there explaining to him that Mark has privileges that he doesn't have because Mark's out of high school, he's in college. And we established a rule that once they graduated from high school, they didn't have to do dishes anymore. And the reason we did that was because, you know, they could leave home and go move in the dormitory or so, and it would cost me a lot more money if they lived in the dormitory. I'd rather have them live at home. And we didn't want them moving out just to get away from the household chores. So we decided to make a distinction there. And it's been very difficult to communicate to the 15-year-old that he still has to do dishes when Mark doesn't. Mark and Amy don't because they're both out of high school. So uniform standards doesn't mean that all the kids do the same thing and abide by the same rules. It means that you need uniform standards based on their age and where they are. Our problem with discipline is that we move between two extremes, don't we? We move between inconsistency and being too severe. And we kind of go from one extreme to the other. And we need to pray daily that God will give us wisdom in finding the balance between those two things. There's a false idea which our society, I think, believes, and that's that if we supply abundant love to our children, if we really love them, then discipline becomes unnecessary. And of course, the scriptures teach just the opposite. In Hebrews 12:6, it points out that because God loves us, He disciplines us. Him whom He loves, He disciplines. And that if we really love our children, we will discipline them. Gordon?
We're meeting the first generation of those on the college campus today.
Mm-hmm.
No concept of discipline from a loving God. Love
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, there's some basic principles in life, and one is that Satan is the deceiver. And he has really sold that idea to our society, that if we really love our kids, we won't discipline them. That's a sign of lack of love, when just the opposite is true. And of course, Satan likes to do that. He likes to take just the opposite thing. He likes to tell us that sin will really be fun. You know, if we really want to have a fun life, we've got to get involved in a lot of sin. And just the opposite is true. The most miserable people you will meet are the people who have really devoted themselves to deep sin, whether it's drugs or alcohol or sex or whatever. And that the way of finding real joy and satisfaction in life is to turn away from those things and follow Christ, which is just the opposite of what the world has been led to believe by Satan. Okay, well, Doris is going to take us through some special problems here now.
Well, these are areas that could be special problems. They don't have to be. The first one is bedtime, and we're thinking on especially of young children. If your children aren't this way, perhaps you've been around children who are, but, you know, the bedtime can take hours. You know, there's an endless number of drinks of water you have to have, or you have to go to the bathroom 10 times, or I need one more story, or there's just all kinds of, you know, keeping bedtime going as long as possible. And I think our son was about 6 months old, and he was laying in his bed crying. That's when he got his first spanking. Bob said, "Is he hungry?" And I said, "No." And, "Is he dry?" "Yes." "Is there any reason for him crying?" "No." And he said, "Well, you know, we better do something." So we gave him a little spanking, and he just settled down and was fine. And then Bob had to really work with me, because I think a mother, just when they cry, you know, you want to go see if they're all right, and you can. But if you listen, you can tell by the cry whether or not there's something really wrong, or if they just want you, they just want to see you again. And I think he really helped me not, you know, run in all the time to see how they were doing. And it can just be a fatiguing job for a mother if they can elongate their, you know, bedtime hour for hours. And instead of doing that, we should make it a really fun time. We've always tried to, when they were little, make it a kind of quieting down period where we read stories and just talked and got them prepared to go to bed. Because as you know, when children are young, if you play active games with them, why, they can just get higher and higher and higher, and they can keep going half the night if you'll let them. So we've kind of always worked at, you know, simmering them down a little. And then I think Chuck Swindoll mentioned in his book just laying beside them at night and just listening to them talk. And a lot of times they'll bring up things. You don't have to say a word. You just lay there, and all of a sudden, you know, they'll just talk to you about something that's on their minds. So bedtime can be a problem, but it can also be a time of real opportunity. And then another time is mealtime. We can give in to their every little whim. You know, "I don't like this," or "I'm not going to eat this." Or we can say, you know, "This is what we eat, and this is what you're going to eat. And if you don't eat this now, you'll eat it before your next meal." And it doesn't take very long. You know, our son says, "I remember sitting at the table till 9:30 one night before I ate my peas." Well, it doesn't take long. I mean, you don't have to do that very often before they, you know, they say, "It's not worth it. I'll just eat it and get it over with." So I think that's a real key, is not to give in to their whims. Because at certain ages, children just seem to go through a very negative stage. And I think we can really help them not develop that type of thing. And often in public, when you're eating in a restaurant or something when they're little, they'll try you to see if you are going to really stick to your guns. And you are going to have to do something about it, even though you don't want to. You know, it's just invariably they're gonna do something that'll, you know, they'll see, I'll see if I can get away with this. And if they get away with it once, they'll do it over and over. And so just, you might as well take the plunge the first time, and they know that it doesn't matter that you're out in public. You're going to discipline them. That doesn't mean that you're going to, you know, whip out your wooden spoon in McDonald's and spank them. You might take them in the restroom, or I've seen several children marched out of church with their fathers, and, you know, they come back in with kind of a pained look. I know. I think that's good. I mean, they learn that they have to behave, and they have to. That's part of discipline, and learning the limits of life is learning how to conduct yourself in different situations. So that can be a good thing. And then another area that can be a problem is lying. And in our family, we've kind of always emphasized that lying is much worse than breaking a rule. I mean, it's bad to break a rule, but it's much worse to lie about breaking the rule. And we try not to put them into a situation where they would be tempted to lie to us. Like if we're going to Bible study and our son has a restriction of no TV that night, we say, okay, you can watch tonight, but tomorrow night when we're home, you won't be able to watch. Because we don't want to put him in a position where he's going to be tempted to turn on the television and watch when we're not there. And then we're going to come home and say, you know, did you? And so we try to avoid that type of situation. And then in attitudes. And, you know, I wish there was some way we could just make them have perfect little attitudes all the time. But since they're like we are, it doesn't work. And I think we feel that they do have to express their frustration. And I think we can put limits on that. But to never let a child, you know, express how he feels. I mean, they don't have to tear the house down, but they should be able to vent their frustration in some way. And otherwise, I think they could develop more severe problems as they grow older. And then I think we've already, in the area of school, invariably you're probably going to have some conflict sometime with the school, and your child's going to come home and tell you what happened. And the best thing to do is to go to the school, either call on the phone or go, and find out from the teacher or from the school side what the facts are, and then make your decision. It's really sad in our society today that the school gets very little backup from the home. I'm talking about public school. I mean, I've talked to teachers, and they'll say, well, it's within the last 5 years. You know, if we do something to discipline a child at school, the parents come in and get on us for picking on their child. Well, see, that's just backwards from, I mean, when I was in school, if I got in trouble at school and my folks found out about it, well, then I usually got it at home, too, for doing something at school. But it's just reversed now. And I think that's, so if you do have problems along that line, get the facts from someone other than your child. They might want to be trying to tell you the truth, but, you know, somehow what it involves them, they can get things mixed up. Okay, I think that's
good. Let me mention one more thing in this area of attitudes that we've discovered, and that's that when they get to be junior high age, everyone agrees that the junior high age is the most difficult time for them attitude-wise. They just, you know, their bodies are changing and everything. There must be a stress on their emotions. But they become very irrational. They say wild things. They act unpleasant. And we have learned to just ignore that. In fact, we just smile at them and say, well, you know, you're going through those junior high years, and, you know, it'll all... So we don't let them get us upset, and we don't take them very seriously during that time, and it passes away in a year or so. And every one of ours has gone through that, and our youngest is just coming out of it now, and we're beginning to see a little saneness from all this wild... You know, they like to see if they can get you upset with some wild statement or something, and if you just kind of don't take them too seriously at that age, it'll make life a lot more pleasant, and they just normally go through that. Manipulation. this is, they're playing one parent against another, and they will try and do this, and this is really part of parents being in agreement, and we really have to watch that we don't allow them to do that. And in fact, the first question I always ask when they come and say, can I do something, or, you know, could we do this, or I say, well, have you talked to Doris about it? I always ask first to find out if they've talked with Doris, and if they haven't, they say, what did Doris say? And then whatever she said, I back her up on that, and she does the same with me. And if we don't really agree, then we go privately and talk about it, and don't do that in front of the kids. And it doesn't take them long to realize that that tactic isn't going to work, that mom and dad are in agreement, and they're not going to manipulate us one against the other. Now, I heard a staff member tell me about his boy who was on a little league ball team or some kind of a athletic team, and the father had been to, six or seven games already that the child was in, and then the father was away on a trip, and the child said to the mother, you know, why isn't Daddy coming to watch my game? Doesn't he love us, or doesn't he care about us? And she said, well, honey, he's been to six games. And our children will try and manipulate us in any way they can. And of course, we don't want to put the ministry ahead of our families, but we can go overboard the other way also. Then the last point is that children are smarter than we think. And John brought this out, that a six-month-old can already understand his name and the difference when he's done something that deserves discipline and so on. And we have found that our kids tend to always be further developed than we realize. You know, just when we think they've gotten at that level, then they're at this level. So our understanding goes up to here, and then by then they're up there, and they're always ahead of us. They can always accept more responsibility than we think they can, and understand more than we think they can, and do more than we think they can. And last summer, our youngest son, we had moved into a house that needed a lot of work on it, and one of the things we wanted to do was build a wall down in the basement to separate the furnace room from the recreation room. And so my, at that time, 14-year-old son said, well, you know, could I do that? And I didn't really think he could, but I didn't want to squelch his initiative, so I said, sure, you know, you draw up what you want to do and figure out the materials, and I helped him figure out how close together the 2x4 should be and everything. And we got the stuff, and he set about, and I was amazed. He did a great job. Boy, the wall is there, and it's straight, and it's not bad at all. I didn't think he could do it, but he did it. So they're always ahead. And, of course, from the discipline standpoint, when they're younger, that means that we're usually behind their understanding level, that they can be more responsible than we're giving them credit for. And then as they get older, they can do more things than we think they can. Well, our time is about up. And any questions before we break up? Gordon?
One question about attitudes and dealing with them. I know we don't want to reinforce negative attitudes or destructive attitudes. So how do you, you know, as a child, especially junior high, how do you deal with those and still, like you said, roll with the punches and don't make it a big deal? In other words, if you see a bad attitude in the midst of all that, how do you deal with that?
Well, it seems like a basic principle in discipline is to try and figure out what is the child trying to accomplish by his behavior. And in junior high, they tend to want to get you upset. And so if you don't get upset, you've spoiled their fun, see. And you've made it non-profitable activity on their part. If you just, you know, don't really take them that seriously. It's like the little six-month-old baby who cries, and when he has everything he needs, he just wants attention. And by giving him the attention, by going in the room every time he cries and giving him the attention, you're reinforcing he's getting success from his behavior. But if it doesn't produce anything, he'll figure out something else to do pretty soon. Helen.
Well, like our son, it's a non-upset, and that gets me upset. Should I
No, we try and yeah. We try and keep some order in the home as much as possible and not allow them to get on one another. And sometimes with three, see, we have three, and two will get on one and just really go after them. Sometimes it's the two boys against the girl, or the two old ones against the youngest one, or the two young ones against the old one. And we just have to not allow that type of thing. Discipline, mm-hmm. Whether it's spanking, you know, depending on their age or withholding privilege or...
I think as they get older, you just have to separate. Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.
We have to do that. One goes out to feed his animals, comes in, uses the bathroom, while the other one goes out to feed theirs. Because otherwise, they just tease each other. They're not mean, or they just get into squabbles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that type of thing just grows, see, teasing. Now, Doris comes from a big family, that teasing was a big thing. And, you know, we've talked about this and how it can just build on itself and just becomes the main activity of the family when they're together. It's like mealtime. You know, the main activity at mealtime can be, man, the beans, these beans are terrible. Why can't we have this? You know, why don't we have enchiladas every night? And so on. If you allow those negative comments, they'll just take over rather than making it the most profitable time it can be. Mealtime can be the most profitable family time there is by the conversation.
What about when they're younger, like an 18-month-old, a 4-year-old will set up her own little house, what she calls her house, and my 18-month-old come in and kind of just be destructive, come, you know, she's not meaning to, which, and then, you know, Jody,
the older one,
will start knowing
that the
little one,
you
know what,
you
know, about what she's doing.
Do
I separate them at an early age, too, or?
I think you do, because, I mean, of course, part of life is that people are always going to be coming and doing things that you don't want to be doing.
Messing up your stuff.
I was wondering if I was avoiding the problem, or does this have to do with just their respecting their rights?
But I think they do have to have a place where, you know, if they like everything nice and orderly and neat, that they can have it that way and have a child just come in and mess it up.
Yeah, we've tried to enforce, see, as they need to respect our rights, we need to respect their rights, and they need to respect one another's rights. You know, this is Mark's stuff, and you don't use it without asking him, and you don't go into his room and do things without his permission and so on. John? It's a basic principle in life that we need to respect the rights of other people, property rights, personal rights, and so on. Any other question? Okay, well, tomorrow we'll get into this matter of training and spend most of the session on that. So let's have a word of prayer and break up. Father, when we talk about this very important subject, we need your guidance and your help. We know that each one of these children is different. And you've made them different for a purpose. And we don't want to force them into some mold that is not your plan for them. And help us to take principles and apply them and to examine your scriptures and find out what you want each one of us to do in these areas. And help us to be consistent in discipline and to realize the importance of it. And help us to be setting the pace in our lives for our children. Help us to be living the kind of lives that we want them to live. And we know that this is not possible apart from the work of your Holy Spirit in us and through us. And we ask that also for this seminar, that your Holy Spirit would be our teacher and would cause any good to come and would strike from the memory any things that are not of yourself. In Jesus' name, amen.